What Keeps You Up at Night, Season 2, The Night I Didn't Sleep.
On February 24th, 2022, millions of Ukrainians across the country woke up to the sound of air raids and explosions. Russia had just launched a full-scale invasion.
Good evening, and we're coming on the air at this hour with breaking news after the U.S. warned all day of a full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine.
As the war in Ukraine has begun.
Ukraine woke to explosions around the capital, Kiev.
Gunfire and explosions have been heard here and in the second city of Kharkiv shortly after the Russian President Vladimir Putin.
Over the past 600 days, tens of cities have been razed to the ground, thousands of soldiers and civilians killed, and millions of refugees displaced. But the war didn't start on February 24th. It started 9 years ago. November 21st, 2013. Ukraine had negotiated an association agreement with the EU. It was a big deal. The agreement included a free trade deal and was seen as the first step towards possible future membership. But a week before the signing, Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych reversed course and decided to opt for closer ties with Russia, specifically economic ties.
A miracle didn't happen.
Let's get to the latest twist in the love-hate triangle that is the tussle between Russia and the EU over its stepchild, the Ukraine.
And European Union leaders and Ukraine have, as expected, failed to sign an historic free trade deal after...
That night, hundreds gathered on Ukraine's central Maidan Square to protest the decisions. But the numbers really grew on Sunday's mass rally organized by the opposition.
I was there from the very beginning to the end.
Retired veteran Sergei came out on Sunday to support Ukraine's EU course after hearing about the protest on television.
Everyone stood there and shouted a little. Then it was over and we started leaving. Some students, girls and boys, formed a human chain to block people and began to shout.
Don't disperse. We won't achieve anything like this. Let's stand here until the end.
It was etched into my memory. That's why I kept coming. To support.
This was the beginning of Maidan. The government did not respond to the protesters' demands. Not long after, people started setting up tents and barricades. The very heart of Kyiv's center became a political fortress. People soon began to protest not only against the agreement, but the president's corrupt and authoritarian regime.
I came to Maidan almost every evening, with to have a drink, to hang out, and fulfill my civic duty. People started bringing food. Grandmas brought either jam or stew, and they set up field kitchens. When it started to get cold, in tents, they placed pots and stoves. There were more and more people every day. People came from different places, from Kirovograd, from Cherkasy. I was from Zaporizhia. There were some from Crimea, from Sevastopol. Many times, I spent the night on the Maidan.
Maidan was regularly attacked by the Ukrainian police, then called the Militsiya and the Berkut, who were the designated riot police. Sergei's role was to defend the square.
They tried to break through there several times. There was a strong will from Maidan that we will stand and we will not leave. 10 people per tent left for 3 hours and went on duty to control entries on Maidan. And then, after 3 hours, they switched. Everyone gathered every evening at about 6 o'clock because the assaults began at night. And so we had to go out and to be on duty, because if something happened, we would have to raise alarm. Every night kept us on high alert.
The situation quickly escalated. In January, the government approved a new legislation that made it a crime to wear masks or helmets banned the dissemination of slander on the internet, and allowed for jail terms of up to 5 years for those who blocked public buildings.
They started shooting. More and more people were hurt, mostly in the head. To protect themselves, people got really creative. They would put pieces of styrofoam held by rubber bands to protect themselves from the police batons. Many people cut shields out of plywood. At some warehouses, people found some helmets, plastic, motorcycle helmets, which we started wearing to defend.
Violence kept escalating. Maidan representatives and opposition leaders tried to negotiate with the president. On February 18th, the protesters decided to act themselves. 20,000 people advanced to the Verkhovna Rada, the Ukrainian parliament.
The Mariinsky Park, on the way to the parliament, there were already large cordons of tituski, mercenaries agents who supported Yanukovych. And then the shooting started in the park. Everyone went back to Maidan, where they could, because at that point, police started catching people. The police also pulled themselves up and began to surround Maidan. It was around 3 or 4. Some of the people started to disperse because it was already scary when they started shooting. There was a stage used by politicians. On loudspeakers, someone started calling everyone to fight. Then people started calling their friends. Get up, everyone! To Maidan! You need to stand with your chest! We have to survive that night! The authorities planned to turn off the electricity completely in the area to storm Maidan, and then shoot everyone who was there. It was a horde of black mass. The night was dreadful. It was the first serious assault on the Maidan. The police began to throw incendiary mixtures at tents. Our tent burned down. I had my things there, camera, documents, everything. People realized that this was serious when the first people were killed. In front of the bullets, people just started dismantling these paving stones near the pedestal. It was small bricks, they were 10 by 10, so they were convenient to throw. I even have such a brick in my aquarium in Zaporizhia. I left it as a memory. The wind blew from Maidan to the police, so people got tires and burned them, which created a curtain of smoke between the Maidan and the police. Then water cannons arrived. Can you imagine? Water cannons in winter, in February, and they're spraying water. And then, yeah, you get cold, but you warm yourself where the tents are burning. When you're faced with death, well, you either have to stand or run. Well, somehow, everyone decided that we would stand to the end, all the way there.
As tensions grew, EU Ambassador Jan Tumbinski realized that the country was on a brink of a civil war.
The tension rose in Kyiv. The situation went from bad to worse, with confrontation being more violent on the streets.
European leaders decided to organize negotiations between the president and the oppositions in Kyiv to avoid an escalation of the situation. The Polish Minister of Foreign Affairs, Radoslav Sikorski, the German Ministers of Foreign Affairs, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, and the French Minister, Laurent Fabius, arrived in Kyiv on February 20th to moderate the talks.
We came to the administration, we came to the building of president, hundreds and hundreds of policemen of different units were gathering around the presidential administration in Kyiv. So quite a strange picture. Very strong security measures were applied. We were checked by people in military fatigue searching for phones. They were armed, something that I've never seen before. So we were deprived of our phones. We entered a meeting with president, and there was a strange ambience. The first part of our talks happened in a room where usually a president was meeting with international foreign delegations, with windows getting to the side of the main square in Kiev, where this confrontation happened. So we heard all these sounds of explosions, shootings through the window. These noises came to us. President seemed to be rather relaxed, as if he did not even notice what happened some hundred meters away from him, and started in his usual way also monologuing. This was his way of dominating space and discussion, to start talking. And at a certain moment, Minister Steinmeier interrupted this monologue and asked directly questions. What are the intentions of president, whether he intends to change the government, and how to appease the situation and to end the conflict. Suddenly, Yanukovych was called to a phone, and he interrupted the meeting with us. We realized then later on that it was Chancellor Merkel calling him. And we had the possibility to get to our phones. And then we received all information about people being shot by the special units.
So Maidan Square in Kiev transformed from a protest site into a killing ground.
Protesters confronting security services, who respond with live ammunition.
Over 3 days, up to 100 people were shot dead as police clashed with anti-government protesters. Now a site of tribute.
So we returned to these discussions with Yanukovych, saying him, President, but do you know what's happening around you? His answer was completely irrealistic in the context of what happened. He said, I've heard that some radicals are running around the city and shooting on people. He tried to take it as something that is not under his control, just to blame the other side. But nobody believed him. This was theater. So theater belongs also to negotiations. Finally, we decided to conclude this discussion with Yanukovych and proposing him that we will return and we will convince also leaders of opposition, leaders of Maidan, to come and to negotiate with President an agreement on cessation of violence.
I woke up at 8 o'clock that morning. It was clear in the broadcasts already that something was starting on Maidan. And I don't even remember if I already saw in the live streams that people were dying. I must have already heard. My cousin called me and said that my friend Bogdan was missing, asking me to come and help and look for him.
Olga Salo was a Ukrainian activist on Maidan. The night before, her cousin Pavlo and his friends came to Kiev from Lviv. They wanted to join the protest. As Jan Tambinsky was preparing for negotiations, Olga's friends had gone to help with the defense in Maidan on the street of Institutskaya. It is a long street leading from Maidan up to the president's administration, where the negotiations would later take place.
My friends went to Maidan in the morning. They were in the alley of the Heavenly Hundred, then called Institutska. A few men were bringing down someone who was seriously injured, and they said, "Guys, help, it's urgently necessary to bring him down." So my friends took the wounded man and carried him farther, but my friend Bogdan stayed in the street and they lost sight of him. I gathered myself right away and went down to the Maidan. It looked very strange, devastated and so depressed. Well, it was sometime between 9 and 10 o'clock in the morning. This is when the heaviest shootings took place. I decided to go to those medical points and look. Maybe he got really hurt and was brought there already by someone. I went down Sofivskaya to the Maidan where I saw the laid out bodies of the dead. But I tell myself, don't focus on that. I promised that I would walk through the med points and look for Bogdan there. And then I see more dead bodies lying on Maidan, closer to Krestiatuk. I stopped in the street and my brother called. He said, that's it. Bogdan is gone. I came back to those who died, who were lying on the side of Sofivskaya. And then I saw my brother, Bogdan's body, but I did not look. He was already covered. I decided I didn't want to see that. It is difficult to describe what one can feel, what a person can feel, who sees killed people, absolutely peaceful in the middle of the street, and knows that among these people is your friend. And this is a feeling of absolute wrongness. People see someone has been carried away again, and you don't know if he's wounded or killed. And I told myself that you can't cry now or show any emotions. Now is not the time. Nothing is over yet. On Maidan, we all had a general understanding that we had to report to the police department and testify about the crimes committed. So my brother and I went to the police department. It was extremely uncomfortable. We were in the territory of the security forces, who, in our understanding, had just shot at peaceful protesters. And we already knew that many protesters died. But security forces and policemen had also died. And it was really like, there is us, and then there is them. And you could feel it in everything. We were there for a long time. We were waiting for this investigator in the corridor while he was preparing something. He had other people there. Pavlo, my cousin, said, let's go outside because, well, this is dreadful. There is such an atmosphere that you just want to run away from there faster. Outside, it was a depressing mood because everybody was thinking about the same thing. A mass murder has just happened. And now, in the midst of it all, we have to testify about it. There was a man standing with a big bag of clothes who was obviously very worried. And I asked him, did you also lose someone close? He started yelling and insulting me. And it turned out it was the father of a policeman who brought some clothes for his son because the police also did not come home for several days. For this man, we were the aggressors. The investigator finally called us to testify. We went into a large, spacious room for 4 to 10 people, but he was in there alone. In the center, there were garbage bags with people's belongings, which emitted a very unpleasant smell. They were all signed and marked. I asked the investigator what was inside, and he said that these were belongings of dead policemen. In one department, people came to testify about the death of protesters, and they also collected evidence for the death of policemen. The bodies were then taken to the morgue. My cousin and Bogdan's cousin came to identify him. My function was to make sure that the authorities didn't start driving out the bodies from the morgue. We all expected it to happen. There was such fear in the room. I remember that by the morgue, there were many relatives of the fallen protesters. At first, they didn't even let them in for identification. And finally, there was a moment when Bogdan's body was handed over. He was to be taken to Lviv, but first the bodies were taken to Maidan, where people could say goodbye, and then sent on. This process of mourning was very important for everyone.
Meanwhile, a pivotal night with no sleep awaited the European representative, Jan Tombinski. The EU representatives were joined by the president and the opposition leaders Yatsenyuk, Klitschko, and Yevgeny Barak. Russia also sent an envoy, Vladimir Lukin, at the request of Yanukovych after his phone call with Putin.
We returned in the evening to the presidential administration and the negotiations started.
For 10 hours, EU representatives would moderate talks between the opposition and Yanukovych to form a transitory government, to understand how to organize future elections, and how to return to a parliamentary constitution.
It was by far the most important and dramatic negotiations I participated, because what was at stake? Life of people, life of a country, civil war. It was the whole night discussion, fight for words, how to get an arrangement between those in power and the opposition to stop the violence and to overcome the conflict. From more or less 9 in the evening until 7 in the morning. This is a very specific situation. How to see it as a third part and trying to calm down tensions, to force people to talk each to other. It was strange for an observer to see these people who called each other by name, who knew families of the others, so disputed that an external presence, a foreign presence, was needed to bring them to one table, to sit there, and to look for solutions. We were very careful in controlling emotions between both sides, not to allow accusations. Let us focus on future. Let us put the past aside. This will be eventually dealt with in a future where archives, documents are opened. This requires a lot of patience. This requires also to put you in a situation of not an emotional participant to this talks, but as facilitator. So a bit to step out of yourself, to leave your emotions, your personal judgment. We were printing consecutive versions of the text to work on it further. If we do not agree on this point, let us go to another point. Then probably here we would find a solution, and we eventually then return to another point that were more disputed than others. During this discussions that took us almost 10 hours during the night, there was no service in the chancellery, so we were going to make teas all together from both sides, some sandwiches with what we found in a small kitchen close to the place where the talks happened, with funny situations that people from opposition offered sandwiches to Yanukovych or vice versa. There was a certain conviviality during these dramatic negotiations. So we were staying all together. It also helps if people do stay in one room, if they are in this personal contact, if they see each other in the eyes. It helps to create a sense of a common purpose, and it helps also to overcome certain tensions. President Yanukovych was not convinced to seize on his competences and to agree to several elements of this agreement. He was changing during this night from a person who was self-confident and still master of the game, to a person that was progressively accepting that he's losing power. And this was probably something that happened overnight. Some messages from inside of his party, from his collaborators were forcing him to concede, because many of his closest people were also very much afraid of what's going on in the country, and they wanted this crisis to end and to find a solution. So they were ready to sacrifice the president to get to an agreement. And I guess he felt it.
After 10 hours of negotiations, President Yanukovych and the opposition came to an agreement. Maidan would be evacuated. The president's mandate would be shortened. A transitory government would be created, and the constitution would be changed. Russia's demand to evacuate Maidan and not to involve international organizations to monitor the agreement were also fulfilled. The Russian envoy, Vladimir Lukin, went back to Russia in the morning with no explanation.
We all were very tired, exhausted in a way, but satisfied that finally there was no break and that both sides engaged, that we managed to keep both sides at the table. We knew that there was no good solution in this situation. This was most probably, as we saw it, a victory of president over the opposition, because finally, after what happened on the streets with all these victims, he would stay as a president. And I insisted at the time on immediate signing. I didn't want to give time for any actions that would eventually reverse or change the context. But Yanukovych proposed, no, this is so important, let us meet at 12 o'clock and then sign this agreement in front of cameras because people were waiting for it. We came to the presidential building before 12 with ministers, but the opposition did not appear. The leaders of the opposition were confronted with resistance of the Council of Maidan, the representatives of different organizations present at the Maidan. They were also in a very delicate situation because they had to justify to people on the streets why to engage with authorities that were responsible for killing so many people, how to sit at one table with those who ordered police and other units to charge on people. So we left the administration and we joined the meeting of the Council of Maidan. And the discussion, the ambience was very dense. There were several people determined to block any agreement with president.
So they were trying to negotiate a compromise agreement between Yanukovych and political parties who were in opposition.
Oleksiy Haran, a professor at Kiev Mohyla Academy, was a member of the Council of Maidan. The council was made up of 30 people. There were journalists, academics, and politicians in charge of representing the protesters.
And they reached kind of agreement. And after they reached this agreement, they understood that they need to legitimize it, because Maidan would not accept a deal which was done secretly without any consultation with Maidan. So they summoned us to a hotel in the center of the city, nearby actually presidential administration. And we were there and we were presented with a document which was prepared between president and opposition political parties with participation of international mediators. There were many open questions in this one-page document, and it wasn't clear. It was open to manipulation. It was stated that it's necessary to have a coalition government. But, you know, it was just a statement, and we put the question, how this coalition government would be created? Who would take important position in the government? And there were no answers in this document. And Yanukovych, according to this document, Yanukovych would remain the president until the end of the year, after all the killings in Maidan. So people didn't want him to stay, both in Maidan and in the Council of Maidan. So we in the Council of Maidan, we said that no, we cannot accept this document. And at that point, we were told by international mediators that this is the best document which could be reached at that point. You cannot prepare another document. Either you sign it or the confrontation would continue, and we are not responsible for what would happen. So basically, we were blackmailed. International mediators, they were pressing us, and Polish Minister of Foreign Affairs said that if you don't support it, all of you will die.
You have the armies, you will all be dead.
The Polish foreign minister has been filmed telling a Ukrainian protest leader that if the opposition don't support a peace deal, they'll have martial law, adding, you will all be dead. Radoslav Sikorsky made the comment during talks in Kiev aimed at ending the violent standoff which claimed 77 lives in the space of 48 hours, leaving 600 wounded. The protesters had been.
But we were blackmailed, so we decided to support the documents, but we clearly stated that this document would not be supported by Maidan as a whole.
At the beginning of the signing ceremony, everyone in front of the table, cameras on the other side, documents put on the table, and Oleh Tjachny Bog, leader of Samoobrona, asked everyone to honor with a minute of silence all people shot on the Maidan. It was very strange situation seeing all these people on both sides, staying for a minute in a silence to honor all those who were dead on the Maidan. It was very moving.
The shooting there has now stopped and the president has backed down. Under pressure from European leaders, Viktor Yanukovych signed a peace deal with the opposition and he has agreed to early elections, but his opponents say it's not nearly enough that Yanukovych now...
They signed it with a general understanding. We should give a chance to the future. Staying in a confrontation, staying in the stalemate, will not bring any positive results to neither of the sides.
After signing the agreement, President Yanukovych returned home to his luxurious mansion, which had an animal farm, exquisite artworks, and a golden toilet, packed his bags, and flew to Russia, never to set foot in Ukraine again.
The BBC can't independently verify this footage, but video has emerged which appears to show President Yanukovych's entourage fleeing from his luxurious mansion outside Kiev.
Moving developments in Ukraine after those deadly protests, the government firing back. The president tonight is in hiding.
The president, with his power crumbling, fled the capital, and his compound was taken over by protesters.
The next day, the parliament voted to revoke the president and hold early elections in May.
We are sitting in a cafe, drinking tea and watching the news on TV. It's around 5 o'clock in the evening, and the parliament removed Yanukovych from the duties of the president. I had the feeling that this was the end, and probably the end of Maidan, a positive end. I say to one of my friends, "Listen, I think this is a victory." The next day, Maidan became filled with people. But this was different. It wasn't a protest anymore, but a rally. Maidan was still processing everything that had just been lived through. It seems to me that this feeling of victory was perhaps for just one evening. And later, it became clear that everything, everything, will be much, much more difficult than it had been for those few bloody days.
Days after the revolution, Russian convoys entered Crimea in unidentified military uniforms. They immediately took the peninsula under control and proclaimed its annexation in March 2014 after a sham referendum. Armed men without insignia began taking over government buildings in Donetsk and Luhansk regions. In the meantime, pro-Russian demonstrations began to appear in eastern Ukraine. They were organized by Russian citizens who collaborated with Kremlin-linked politicians. The Ukrainian military made some gains but was unable to regain most of the territory. Amid a standstill conflict, the once prosperous regions descended into poverty. 8 years of ongoing fighting led to the death of 8,000 people.
A war because of an agreement. Nobody on the European side would expect it and considered it plausible because it is against all reasoning. Such a war with so many casualties brings nothing, not a solution whatsoever. There were other actors playing along a completely different play screen. Russia. So we were probably sitting with the wrong partner at the table.
This episode was produced by Agata Gorski, Bilge Kotan, Katarzyna Skiba, and Margot Ferrand. Our editor-in-chief was Lorraine Bess. Thank you all who participated in this episode. Listen to other episodes of What Keeps You Up at Night on Sciences Po website and on all platforms.